This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been about a month since the Iraqis were forced out of Kuwait. The Kuwaiti men and women who resisted the Iraqis after the ruling family fled want more of a say in their post-war government. Daniel Pipe says a more democratic system would not only be in the best interests of Kuwait, it would be in the best interests of the U.S. But he's worried about what will happen if the ruling al-Sabah family resists sharing the power. Pipes is the director of the Philadelphia-based think tank, the Foreign Policy Research Institute, and he's the author of several books on the Middle East. He was in Kuwait a week and a half ago. While he was there, he toured the palace that was used as Iraq's military headquarters.
And in the basement of this very substantial house, a very nicely built house, is the famous map that the Iraqis had built to indicate where their forces were and where the American assault was going to take place. The map is about 30 feet long, 20 feet wide. The land is represented by plain sand, and the water is represented by blue-tinted sand. It has some bizarre qualities to it. For example, the buildings of Kuwait City and the installations that they need to represent are shown with Lego blocks and styrofoam. Even more bizarre is the fact that just two stories above this basement operations center were a series of torture rooms. You could see the implements. You could see the bed frames that were hooked up to the electricity grid, to the electricity. You could see the various implements that they used. Perhaps strangest of all and most ghastly of all was a Chinese implement, which seemed to be an industrially made torture implement from all that we could tell. But what was most striking to me about this entire house is the fact that they could have an operation center in the basement and a torture chamber on the second floor. Now,
what's shocking about that?
Well, that the two should be so closely connected. I mean, I don't even think the Nazis did that. In other words, the military leadership does not engage in torture, and it has nothing to do with this sort of thing normally. It might be fighting for a regime that does engage in it, but it itself does not. And what is so striking about this case is that it was, I mean, right cheek by jowl with Operation Center is torture. Now, there's no torturing for military information. The Kuwaitis didn't know anything. It was just torture for whatever purpose they had in mind. And I was just so amazed that torture could be taking place in the same small building as the operation center. It implies that it's just part of the system in a way that I never encountered before in any regime.
What are your fears about the political future of Kuwait now?
I fear that the ruling family is not going to let go of power fast enough so that the country rebuild. They won't trust others to rebuild it, and that they won't trust others with political power. And that those who have lived through the occupation will be unwilling to accept this anymore. And I can easily picture violence, political disturbances, even civil insurrection. So it's absolutely critical that the ruling family realize that a major change has taken place. There's no returning to the way it was. And they better realize it quick.
You would like to see the United States encourage the al-Sabah family to relinquish some of their power and democratize the country a little bit, basically to become a constitutional monarchy. What would you propose that the United States do along those lines?
I have a very simple idea. The president has announced that he's going to Kuwait or to the Middle East in a month, and I'd urge him to get there faster, because I don't know if a month can wait. If it can wait for a month, I would urge him to get to Kuwait in particular, take a victory tour, see the torture room, see the gas, see the gas fields burning, see the various sites, and then talk to the emir, or the crown prince, who's really making decisions these days, and tell him that he better make changes. That he might give him a little civics lesson on democracy. He might remind him of the fact that his government is on the record acknowledging the need to go back to the 1962 Constitution with its provisions for democracy. Press him for a date for the elections. Press him for some commitments about what the parliament will do, that it won't just be consultative, but actually make decisions. And on the level of the material problems, the electricity infrastructure, oil fields burning, I would suggest that the president press the emir to make decisions, make them quickly, and give authorization for money to be spent. and that the president give his personal word of honor that the American firms that are engaged to do work will do their work with dispatch and do high-quality work. And then he turns around to those firms and says, look, this is not just a commercial undertaking. This is a matter of the United States national interest. It's very important for us that the work you do be good. It's a, you know, kind of quasi-military undertaking, that this is something larger than what it appears to be. It's very important to us. And then perhaps with that combination of his pressure on the Kuwaiti leadership and his turning to the American corporations, that the work really would be done very well. I have no doubt that they could do it.
You know, Samir Al-Khalil, who people will know as the author of Republic of Fear, a book about Iraq, he had an op-ed piece today in the New York Times. And he said that he thinks the United States should march to Baghdad and support the insurgents. What do you think?
It's a tempting idea, and it's part of our tradition. We did it in Japan, we did it in Germany, we did it in Panama, we did it in Grenada. We move in, we get rid of the old crew, we democratize, we give them institutions in our image, we clean them up, we arrange for a defense treaty, and then we leave. Very tempting, and has some major successes to its credit. I'm very skeptical, however, in the case of Iraq. I think that Iraq is different, and basically because it's a Muslim country, and basically because there are a whole range of attitudes, of suspicions about us, which are going to make it very much more difficult to put in our institutions and our people and leave them there and wish them Godspeed and form alliance with them. So if I thought that was possible, I would agree with him, and I would have a clear vision of what the United States should do. As I am skeptical of it, as I'm fearful of it, in fact, I don't really know what to do that goes much beyond what the U.S. government is doing, which is to stay on the sidelines and influence the civil war in small ways.
Do you feel like we really left a mess that we never expected in Iraq? We've not only bombed them back to pre-industrial era, but we created the setting for an insurrection, but the insurrectionists are getting slaughtered from the reports that we hear.
It's a very hard thing to do, to program a civil war from the outside. Perhaps there's more we can do. I'm of two minds, I must admit. I would love nothing more dearly than the ouster of Saddam Hussein. I would happily contribute to a strangulation myself. On the other hand, I worry that if he's gone, there will be what they call Lebanonization of Iraq, and that it will be a source of unending violence and trouble for the outside world in the years to come. And then maybe better to leave Saddam there and have the country remain whole, not have incursions by its neighbors, not have endless ethnic and civil war. I'm not on the spot. I don't have to make that decision, which I prefer. But I feel somewhat indecisive about it. Both of them are rather terrifying prospects.
When people describe the Lebanonization of Iraq, what exactly do they mean?
Well, by Lebanonization, they mean that the common denominator is exploded, and every person reverts back to his ethnic group. Now, it's not because of a newfound piety, but it's because you don't trust anyone. In other words, in Iraq, as Samir Al-Khalil has shown us, in Iraq, there's so little trust between people, the informers are everywhere, that you revert back to your own, because at least you can trust them more. And so you turn to your family and to your kin and to your ethnic group. And everyone does that simultaneously because they're all fearful. And as a result, you have a ethnic grouping of society, and there's warfare along the lines of Kurdish and Sunni Arab and Shi'a Arab, and perhaps even smaller units than that, that just goes on and on. I mean, Lebanon, it's been going on now for 16 years.
Dan Pipes, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Dan Pipes is the director of the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia. Coming up, a report on human rights violations by Iraqis and Kuwaitis in Kuwait, a report that challenges some of what we've been hearing. This is Fresh Air. We've all heard reports about atrocities committed by Iraqis against Kuwaitis during the Iraqi occupation of the country. And since the liberation, stories have emerged about Kuwaitis seeking revenge against Iraqi soldiers, collaborators, and alleged collaborators. Andrew Whitley is executive director of the human rights group Middle East Watch. Last weekend, he returned from 12 days in Kuwait. Whitley went there to separate fact from fiction in these reports. One of his findings was that Iraqi brutality was selective and ruthless, rather than widespread and indiscriminate.
The Iraqis concentrated very much on those who they perceived to be a source of resistance, either active resistance or passive resistance. And where they saw that resistance coming, even from people who didn't change their identity cards to the new prescribed Iraqi identity cards, they took those people in for questioning, and once they fell into the hands of the Iraqi intelligence forces, then they might have been held sometimes for a long period of time to be maltreated, perhaps to try to extract further information from them, and occasionally to be killed, but usually to be released after interrogation. But I think it's worthwhile stating that the Iraqis, when they did put the pressure on certain groups, certain communities within Kuwait, that they were quite ruthless. They had no qualms at all about taking people out for execution from neighborhoods to make an example of them where there had been a certain amount of resistance activity. I saw bodies which had been very badly mutilated, and they were clearly intended as examples to the community and to their neighbors.
So are you suggesting that reports of violence by Iraqis against Kuwaitis was exaggerated?
It was certainly exaggerated in scale, and some of the more lurid atrocity stories simply didn't happen, and I think that was part of the disinformation that took place during the course of the war, disinformation that was assiduously spread by the Kuwaiti government in exile, and to some extent picked up by Western politicians, including President Bush, for his very own obvious goals of mobilizing public opinion in the United States.
But you're calling this disinformation. How was it spread? Who was behind it?
It was spread by officials of the Kuwaiti government who would stand up in public fora, including the United Nations, and make certain allegations, for example, over the removal of premature babies from incubators in Kuwaiti hospitals. That story, which was given wide circulation by Amnesty International, among others, simply never took place. We'd heard about 312 premature babies had died. And I can now state categorically, having gone round all the main hospitals, having checked the incubators, seeing that they're all there, that that was a canard, as one resistance fighter told me.
Do you think that individuals lied or exaggerated about what was done to them? Because we've heard so many reports from individuals, by reporters who've been to Kuwait.
I believe that they did lie. I think that sometimes they convinced themselves, though, and perhaps this is a more charitable way to put it, that things had happened to them or to their relatives, when in fact it was more secondhand. I can give you one very good example, which was a story that I was determined to track down. It was a story that's been given widespread currency inside Kuwait, and it suggests that a group of women one day in a middle-class neighborhood of Kuwait City were picked up one after another, taken away to various places of detention, severely abused, including unpleasant torture, forced to participate in group sex and other sexual practices, and then eventually killed one after another. And I was determined to try to track down one of the survivors. I was told that only 3 out of a group of 35 women had survived this particular incident. And I eventually, after a long trail, managed to find this particular person, talked to her for an entire afternoon, and came to the conclusion that what she was saying simply never took place.
How did you conclude that?
From a lot of internal evidence, I think this woman was slightly unbalanced, and that, I think, would be a charitable interpretation to put on what many Kuwaitis have gone through. They are suffering from traumatic stress. But from looking at the information that she put across, her inability to be able to remember the names of people who had been with her, her description of the locations where she'd been held, the circumstances under which she'd finally managed to escape and the Iraqis had fled and left her alive and the others had survived. But the point is not whether she had made up this story, but the fact that many Kuwaitis believe this story and is now being repeated as if it were fact around the country.
You're now monitoring human rights violations by Kuwaitis. Is this mostly against people believed to have collaborated with the Iraqis?
Mostly that is the case, but there is a widespread settling of scores with non-Kuwaitis as a whole. It's partly the Palestinians, who are the largest single foreign community in Kuwait. Prior to the invasion, there were about 350,000 people, and were part of one of the oldest and most established of Palestinian communities in the entire Palestinian diaspora. They're suffering now what can only be described as a climate of fear. They are being forced to stay inside their houses. They're being raided in their houses by groups of armed men, some of them claiming to be resistance fighters, some of them not even having that respectability, others members of the armed forces. And this discrimination is taking place on a basis whereby people are being denied foodstuffs, they're being denied access to water, they are not being allowed to go to health clinics to treat their sick or their injured. And unfortunately, there are many Palestinians, we would estimate about 2,000 at present, still in detention, some of whom are unfortunately beginning to turn up dead on the streets of the city. During my time in Kuwait, half a dozen bodies appeared. I saw several of them. They'd been shot in the places where they'd been left. They were Palestinians themselves, and it was unclear why those particular people had been detained. It may be that they did participate in collaborative activities, sometimes in tortures, and it may be that they were purely innocent, that the point is simply that there's no process taking place in Kuwait.
Who's responsible for these acts of violence in Kuwait now? Are they freelancers? Are they members of vigilante groups? Is it more organized than that?
It began as being freelance. I would say that there was a spontaneous outburst of anger on the part of many native Kuwaitis against those who were perceived to have sided with the enemy. And in the first couple of weeks, people were being rounded up indiscriminately by armed men, and they ended up in private homes, and occasionally they'd be released. In more recent weeks, there has been something of a process established. People are being held by members of the armed forces, and they're being held in places which are known to be the brigade headquarters or the division headquarters of the Kuwaiti armed forces. I think the majority of detainees are currently now inside the military hospital or the military prison, and the military hospital is where the commander-in-chief, General Jabba, has his headquarters. They're not being seen by outside observers. Even the International Red Cross, which in theory has permission to see these people, has not been able to get in to see them. So we don't know what's happening to them. Some of them, unfortunately, are also being held in hospitals. We know that hospitals are being used as places for interrogation and for beatings. And that is something which is a matter of grave concern from a human rights point of view.
Is this something very unusual that you're seeing now, or is it not that atypical for a group who has been the victim of torturers to become the torturer themselves?
No, it's not atypical at all. I think this sort of condition takes place in many similar situations where liberation happens and people take out settle their scores with their neighbours. Unfortunately, what I think is different in this situation is that the Kuwaiti armed forces, such as they were, and they were a real ragtag mob of people who were put together by the United States in exile in Saudi Arabia, are now operating there in effect under the blanket cover of US forces, who are there in almost all places of detention. They're in the schools, they're in the prisons or in the military hospital. And the US knows what's going on. The US ambassador said to me that the role that US forces were playing was a restraining one. We have his word for it, and I cannot believe that the US forces are actively participating in acts of torture or execution. There are some instances, though, which suggest that they're standing by and allowing the Kuwaitis to do it. So this is the big difference, that this was an action which took place under the aegis of the United Nations Security Council resolutions. This was the reassertion, the triumph of law. And it's particularly important to make sure that that rule of law remains to be reestablished in the country.
So what would you like to see the United States and or the United Nations do?
In the first instance, they must guarantee that there is access to prisoners and that all of them are accounted for, that they're seen by the Red Cross, which is the best body internationally to be able to guarantee their safety. In the second instance, those who are potentially chargeable for particular offences should be charged. The others should be released within a certain very limited space of time. Thirdly, the United States has to be much more public than it has been so far. I believe it's acting privately, but it needs to send a strong public signal to the Kuwaiti government that this sort of behaviour is simply intolerable, particularly as it involves really senior members of the ruling al-Sabah family.
How are the senior members of the family involved?
They're involved in a way that really is unambiguous. They are organizing militias themselves to hit at their opponents, to be able to terrorize Palestinian neighborhoods. And I have reliable information that Crown Prince Saad, the Crown Prince, has read the Riot Act to these members of the ruling family. We know of seven younger sheikhs who are close to the center of power, who have been, in effect, the organizers of much of this action. And they've been told to stay off the street. Otherwise, if, as the Crown Prince said, they are seen, he will personally hang them.
Now, all of this is happening against the political backdrop of the question, will Kuwait democratize? How do you frame that issue of democracy in Kuwait?
There was a strong head of steam for democracy before the invasion, and it's one which we obviously as an organization would like to encourage and see broadened. What has happened, though, is particularly interesting in that Kuwaiti society now is fractured. It's fractured within itself, between the insiders and the outsiders, the Shia and Sunni Muslim groups, those who are active in the local community self-help organizations, who don't want to be deprived of a sense of their own relevance, their own practical involvement in day-to-day life. They found this a very liberating experience, curiously enough, and they don't want the old ways to be reestablished. So when we talk about democracy, we're talking not just about the restitution of the 1962 constitution or the old National Assembly, which was an effete body, a body restricted to the old leadership, the establishment of the country, but to be able to try and see that those people who did participate in an active way in liberating the country and resisting the occupation are given their own fair share of the fruits of that liberation. And that means not preventing them demonstrating and protesting against the government's incompetence or calling for the resignation of ministers or indeed being able to publish their newspapers. The signs so far are that that is not happening, and that is a worrying sign for the future.
Is there a role you think the United States can play?
The United States can say that in the first instance, elections should be held free of martial law. That's a worry as to what conditions elections are held in, and that the franchise which had existed prior to 1986 when the Constitution was suspended should be broadened to include all sorts of other social groups. What it should also say is that as part of this process of restructuring of Kuwaiti society, and that's something that's going to take place over a long time, the Kuwaitis wish to reduce their entire population by half, that should be done in a humane fashion, in a manner that's in accordance with law, and that at the end of the day, more people should be enfranchised. Those who remain behind should be able to participate in an active part in political life.
Andrew Whitley is Executive Director of Middle East Watch. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.